All right, let's dive into a case today that's all about raisins.
Raisins?
Yeah, raisins, antitrust laws, and states' rights.
Okay.
So picture this, right? It's the Great Depression. California raisin growers are facing a major crisis, way too many raisins. Prices are plummeting, and everyone's struggling.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to think about the context here because California was basically the raisin capital of the world at this point.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They were producing the vast majority of raisins that were consumed in the U.S.
Wow.
So this wasn't just like some small localized issue. This had implications for the entire raisin market.
So it was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
So what happened?
Well, the state of California steps in trying to save the day.
Okay.
They create something called the California Agricultural Prorate Act. This was in 1933, and the goal was to stabilize the market and try to prevent what they called economic waste. The
economic waste.
Yeah.
So how did this program actually work? Was it just like everybody had to start eating raisins for breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Not quite. It was more about controlling what happened to the raisins before they got to the consumer.
Okay.
So in 1940, they implemented a specific raisin marketing program.
Okay.
And here's where it gets interesting.
Okay.
Growers had to hand over their entire raisin crop to the state.
The entire crop?
The entire crop.
Wow. That seems pretty drastic. Was there any pushback on that?
There was, but to understand the pushback, I think we need to kind of break down what happened to all those raisins.
Okay.
So they were sorted into different categories.
Right.
You had your standard raisins, your substandard raisins, and believe it or not, inferior raisins.
Inferior raisins. I mean, I'm suddenly feeling very self-conscious about the wrinkles on my raisins.
Right, yeah. Well, don't worry. It was all about quality control.
Okay.
So a large portion of these raisins, particularly the ones that were deemed inferior, they were placed into what they called a surplus pool.
The surplus pool.
Yeah, and basically taken off the market.
Okay.
To try to avoid further price drops.
That seems...
Then another portion of the raisins went into what they called a stabilization pool.
Okay.
Which the state then controlled. They regulated the price and the timing of when those raisins could be sold.
Interesting.
And then only the remaining raisins, you know, the top tier raisins, those could be sold freely by the growers.
So the state was essentially acting like this giant raisin middleman.
Yeah.
Trying to manipulate the market.
Yeah.
And keep prices from just completely bottoming out.
That's a really good way to put it.
Okay.
But not everyone was thrilled with this whole government intervention.
Right.
And this is where our main character enters the picture.
Oh, okay.
A raisin grower and packer named Porter Brown.
Porter Brown.
He was not a fan of this whole state-controlled raisin operation.
I knew there had to be someone who wasn't on board with this whole raisin regime.
Right.
So what did he do about it?
Well, he decided to fight back, and he filed a lawsuit arguing that this raisin prorate program violated federal antitrust laws, specifically the Sherman Antitrust Act. And his claim was that it was basically a state-sanctioned cartel designed to inflate prices and stifle competition.
So it's like a showdown between a single raisin grower and the state of California.
Exactly.
I mean, this is big. We're talking about, you know, federal power versus states' rights.
Yeah.
Individual liberty versus government regulation.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is going to be fascinating.
It is. And this sets the stage for a landmark Supreme Court case, Parker v. Brown.
Parker v. Brown.
Which grapples with some very fundamental questions about the balance of power in our system.
Okay, so we've got our players, we've got the conflict, and we've got these really big legal principles that are at play.
Right.
So what happens next? Does our raisin-producing hero, Porter Brown, manage to topple this whole government-controlled system?
Well, to find out what the Supreme Court decided and how this case shaped the legal landscape, you're going to have to stick around for part two of our deep dive into Parker v. Brown.
Okay. Welcome back. So last time we left off with raisin grower Porter Brown, you know, challenging California's raisin program, claiming it violated the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Mm-hmm.
He said it was basically, you know, a government-sanctioned monopoly.
Right.
So what happened when this case, Parker v. Brown, landed in the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court had to grapple with a lot of complex issues, and they introduced this legal concept known as the state action doctrine.
The state action doctrine.
Yeah, and this doctrine basically says that states can sometimes take actions that might seem like violations of federal antitrust laws as long as they're acting in their capacity as a sovereign government.
Okay, so are you saying that there's a difference between, like, a group of raisin companies getting together and colluding to fix prices?
Right.
Which would be a clear antitrust violation.
Right, right.
And a state government stepping in to regulate an industry, even if that regulation, you know, has some impact on competition.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the distinction the court was making.
Okay.
The Sherman Act, you know, which is designed to prevent monopolies and unfair business practices, is primarily targeted at private companies, mm-hmm. not at state governments carrying out their regulatory functions.
Interesting. So in this case, the court ultimately sided with California.
They did. They ruled that the Raisin Prorate Program was a legitimate exercise of state power.
Okay.
It fell under the umbrella of the state action doctrine.
Okay.
They emphasized that the Sherman Act was meant to prevent anti-competitive behavior by businesses, not to restrict states from governing in the public interest.
Okay, so round one goes to California.
Right.
But Brown had other arguments up his sleeve, right?
He did.
What about that federal law, the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act?
Right.
Didn't he claim that the California program was clashing with that?
He did. He argued that this federal law, which allowed for federal marketing orders for agricultural products, meant that the federal government should have the ultimate authority over regulating the raisin market.
So his argument was basically like, the feds should have the final say, and California was stepping on their toes.
Essentially, yes.
Okay. But what did the court say about that?
Well, the Supreme Court clarified that the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act didn't actually prohibit states from getting involved in agricultural marketing.
Okay.
In fact, it specifically allows for cooperation between state and federal governments.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, the USDA was actually supporting California's program by providing loans.
Oh, so it kind of backfired on them a little bit.
Right.
So what was the court's reasoning there?
Well, they said they found no conflict between the California program and federal law, especially since there wasn't already a federal raisin program in place.
I see.
It really boiled down to the fact that Congress, in enacting the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act, hadn't explicitly said that states couldn't regulate their own agricultural markets.
Okay. So two arguments down for Brown.
Right.
But he still had one more legal arrow in his quiver.
He did.
He challenged the raisin program based on the Commerce Clause.
You're right. That was his final argument. And his argument was that the California Raisin Program was indirectly impacting interstate commerce because, well, California was the dominant force in the raisin market.
Wait.
He claimed that by controlling so much of the supply, California was overstepping its boundaries and interfering with the federal government's power to regulate interstate commerce.
That makes sense. I mean, if California controlled like the lion's share of the raisin market, any actions that they took would inevitably have ripple effects across state lines.
Right.
So how did the Supreme Court address this Commerce Clause argument?
Well, the court acknowledged that, yes, there was an impact on interstate commerce.
Okay.
However, they emphasized that this impact was incidental to the main purpose of the program, which was to regulate local raisin production before those raisins entered the stream of interstate commerce.
So it's kind of like saying, hey, we're just putting our own house in order here.
Yeah.
And what happens after those raisins leave our state is not really our primary concern. Yeah. I mean, did they really draw such a clear line like that?
You could say that they essentially said that California wasn't trying to control the raisin market outside its borders or discriminate against other states.
Okay.
They were simply trying to solve a local problem with a program that didn't directly conflict with any existing federal regulations.
So three strikes and Porter Brown is out.
Yeah, pretty much.
So what were the long-term implications of this ruling? I mean, did it really change the legal landscape, or was this just a case about raisins?
Well, the implications of Parker v. Brown actually extended far beyond raisins.
Really?
Oh, yeah. This case had a significant impact on the balance of power between state and federal governments.
Wow.
It clarified the scope of the state action doctrine and solidified the principle of state sovereignty.
Okay.
To understand the full significance of this seemingly humble case about raisins, you'll want to join us for the final part of our deep dive.
Okay, so we're back. And I'm still kind of stuck on the fact that Porter Brown, our raisin-producing, you know, crusader, lost on all counts.
Yeah, he did.
It really seems like the Supreme Court sided with California's right to regulate its own agricultural industry.
They did.
Even if it meant like some interference with the free market.
Right. And the implications of Parker v. Brown went far beyond just raisins.
Okay. So you're saying even though this case was about something as, you know, seemingly mundane as raisins, it had these huge consequences.
Absolutely. It did. One of the key takeaways from Parker v. Brown was the solidification of what we call the state action doctrine.
Right, the state action doctrine.
This doctrine essentially gives states a degree of immunity from federal antitrust laws.
Okay.
When they're acting in their sovereign capacity to regulate their own industries.
So it's like a legal shield for states.
Yeah.
Protecting them from antitrust lawsuits.
Yeah.
As long as they're genuinely acting in the public interest.
Right.
But doesn't that kind of open the door for potential abuse?
It's possible.
Couldn't states use this doctrine to, you know, create monopolies in other industries under the guise of regulation?
That's a valid concern, and it's something that courts have grappled with in subsequent cases. Like there was a case called Mid-Cal in 1980 that added some caveats to the state action doctrine.
Uh-huh.
It required states to actively supervise any private actors that were involved in these regulatory programs.
Interesting.
But Parker v. Brown laid the groundwork. It established this crucial legal defense for state governments.
Interesting. So states gain more freedom to regulate industries without the federal government constantly looking over their shoulder.
Right.
What other important principles did this case clarify?
Well, Parker v. Brown also highlighted the principle of state sovereignty, emphasizing that states have the right to come up with their own solutions to local problems, especially when Congress hasn't explicitly legislated in that area.
Uh-huh.
The court essentially said that, you know, if Congress hasn't passed a law directly addressing a specific issue, states have the power to step in, even if their actions indirectly affect interstate commerce.
So it's almost like the court was kind of drawing a line in the sand, saying, federal government, you have your power, states, you have yours.
Right.
Let's try to respect each other's turf.
Exactly.
But how does this case about, you know, depression era raisins affect us today in like the 21st century?
Well, it means that Parker v. Brown remains a relevant and important case.
Really?
Especially as we face new and complex challenges.
Like what?
Well, think about issues like state-level cannabis regulation or renewable energy subsidies.
Okay.
Are these state actions protected under the Parker v. Brown umbrella?
Yeah.
These are questions that courts continue to grapple with.
It's fascinating how, like, a seemingly simple case about raisins had this ripple effect across industries and policy areas.
Yeah.
Who knew those little dried grapes could be so legally potent?
It's a perfect example of how a seemingly narrow legal dispute can have far-reaching consequences.
Yeah.
And it reminds us that the balance of power between state and federal governments is constantly evolving, with cases like Parker v. Brown serving as crucial guideposts along the way.
Well, you have it, folks. We took a deep dive into a case that started with a surplus of raisins and ended up shaping the legal landscape for generations to come. Hopefully you've gained a better understanding of the state action doctrine, the principle of state sovereignty, and maybe even a newfound respect for the legal complexities of the humble raisin.
And perhaps a bit more awareness of how seemingly small legal battles can have significant and lasting impacts on the balance of power in our system.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, stay curious and keep exploring the fascinating world of law and its impact on our lives.